This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
I am very excited to have with me, joining me via Skype, Dr. Catherine Mack, also known as Astro Katie. So Katie is an assistant professor at the Department of Physics at North Carolina State University and works on all manner of things, judging by her bio online. So Katie, on your website, you describe the work that you've covered as things such as dark matter, black holes, galaxy formation, cosmic strings, and the ultimate fate of the universe. So Just all the small questions, really. So is there anything else that you'd like to introduce yourself with and the work that you do?
I think that's I do a lot of different things related to theoretical cosmology and like early universe physics. And I tend to bounce around between topics, going for things that sound really fun and interesting and usually have some kind of particle physics angle to them. So I work on how to better understand the fundamental nature of the universe through astrophysics and cosmology, basically.
Okie dokie. And so you mentioned that you focus on the particle aspect of that. What are the links between particle physics and astrophysics? How do they all link in together and how do you use that in your work?
Well, in the sort of more extreme areas of cosmology, so the Big Bang, you know, the early universe and certain kind of extreme systems, the particle physics becomes really important. So in the early universe, it's really important because everything is super dense and the particle interactions take on a different kind of nature than they do in ordinary situations. And so you have to really understand the underlying particle physics and kind of the fundamental structure of the universe to know what's going on there. And then you have sort of similarly complicated things happening when you deal with stuff like black holes, especially primordial black holes, which is something I've worked on in the past, and then stuff like cosmic strings, where you have this other kind of extreme system where the sort of formation of these hypothetical objects has to do with processes that are usually thought about in terms of the early universe and kind of this particle physics process. So those kinds of questions are really interesting to me because you can unite these two different ways of thinking about the universe and two different ways of approaching what, you know, fundamental reality is really all about. And you can look at it from the huge side, you know, the cosmology side, and also the tiny side, and get insights into, you know, reality from both directions. And these days, a lot of what happens in both particle physics and cosmology have to link to each other, because we are learning a lot about fundamental physics from studying cosmology, and we're learning things about the universe from studying particle interactions in colliders and things. And so there are a lot of really interesting links. And especially in dark matter, which is one of the main things I think about, both of those kind of realms are very, very important.
And so whereabouts is the research currently at? Do we know what dark matter is yet? There's quite a few theories going about, isn't there?
Yeah, we really don't know what it is yet. We are learning a lot about what it isn't. So that's kind of where the advancements are being made at the moment, is ruling things out. But it's getting really interesting because some of the most favored models of the last couple of decades are becoming more and more constrained by the fact that we have not seen evidence of those things yet. So, for example, supersymmetry was supposed to be this really great theory that kind of extends the standard model of particle physics and tells us where to go next in that kind of area of thinking about how particle physics works. And supersymmetry produces a very nice dark matter particle, the neutralino, and you can have it appear at a particular mass and cross-section, and it all works out beautifully on paper. And so a bunch of dark matter experiments were set up that could potentially find that neutralino, that supersymmetric particle. And at the same time, the Large Hadron Collider was all set up, and it was going to find supersymmetry, and everything was going to be great. And those things have not happened. So we have not found the neutralino. We have not found evidence for supersymmetry. The Large Hadron Collider has been fantastically successful in that it found the Higgs boson, but it has not found anything else that really tells us where we should be going with our models of particle physics. So it's a really interesting time with dark matter, because a lot of people who thought, like, oh, okay, we know exactly what we're looking for, are having to think about what else we might be able to look for and which other directions we should take.
And so are you one of those people that is trying to think up of alternative theories about dark matter?
Well, I'm interested in alternative theories about dark matter. I've worked on a couple of different things. So I've worked on axions as dark matter, and that's something that's gotten a bit of a resurgence lately. I've worked on the possibility of primordial black holes as dark matter, another thing that people have talked about a lot lately. But the kind of work I'm doing at the moment is a little bit agnostic as to what the dark matter particle is, as long as it has some kind of particle interactions that could affect the stuff around it. And so I'm thinking about what impact that could have in the early universe. Specifically, one of the things I'm thinking about is if you have a kind of dark matter particle that can have annihilation, so the particles, if they interact with each other, they can annihilate and create particles that we can see. If that happens in the early universe, then it could change how stars and galaxies form in the early universe. So that's one of the things I'm thinking about a lot lately. But I try not to have like a favorite dark matter model where I'm like, oh, I definitely think that's it, partially just to prevent my own disappointment and partially to try to be as, you know, impartial as I can.
What kind of stuff do you have to be looking out for observationally to be able to distinguish between different theories?
Well, so in general with dark matter, there are kind of three ways to try and figure out what dark matter is. There's the there's looking at collider experiments where you try and sort of produce the dark matter particle. That hasn't shown us what the dark matter particle is yet, but that's something that people are still pursuing. There's the direct detection angle where you build a detector that could detect these sort of minuscule interactions between dark matter particles and regular matter particles inside the detector. Again, there have been a lot of interesting little anomalies in direct detection experiments, but so far we haven't said, okay, we got it. And then there's indirect detection, where you look for where dark matter in space might be doing some kind of annihilation or decay or something like that, where you look for heavy concentrations of dark matter, like really dense regions where there's a lot of dark matter, and you see if there's some kind of weird radiation or particle signal coming out of that. And the stuff that I work on is kind of most related to that last scenario, the indirect detection, where what we're really looking for is any sign that dark matter could have been dumping a bunch of energy into the gas where the first stars and galaxies were formed. So a couple of the kinds of signatures you'd look for would be, maybe you'd have fewer of the sort of the really tiniest galaxies, because those galaxies would be more affected by dark matter annihilation, or you might look for things like weird radiation backgrounds in the early universe, where something like radio astronomy would be really helpful to look for that, because these days we're getting to the point where we can see the radio signals from neutral hydrogen around the time the first stars and galaxies were forming. And so if we can see a signature in that, then that tells us something about dark matter potentially. So those are the kinds of signatures I'm looking for in terms of not looking for with my own observations, but the kinds of things where I'm saying, like, this might be a good place to look.
And is that something that could be, those observations could be improved, for example, with the square kilometer array?
Yeah, absolutely. The SKA is the thing that I keep in mind as the best way to test some of the things that I'm doing modeling for.
What aspect of the SKA is that going to be, the low frequency aspect
yes.
of it?
So the low frequency radio astronomy, the idea is that you can get to higher and higher redshift, which is earlier and earlier times, and then you might be able to see something about what's going on with the very first stars and galaxies. And of course, there are a couple of other instruments that could do interesting things. I mean, the EDGES experiment that recently had a very interesting result having to do with the first stars and galaxies, that might tell us something interesting. Although the result that came out is kind of hard to fit into any model of dark matter, and that's been a really interesting thing to think about as well. And it's not clear exactly where that's going.
How was it that it didn't quite fit into the kind of existing ideas about dark matter?
Well, so what EDGES saw was, so they were looking at the absorption of the cosmic microwave background light by the gas in the time of the first galaxies, basically, which would be complicated to go into all the details about that. But what they saw was that it looked like the gas at that time was colder than it should be with the kind of standard models of how the first stars and galaxies should have acted. And one of the possible explanations for the gas being really cold would be that the dark matter was really cold and there was some kind of interaction between the gas and the dark matter that cooled down the gas to a lower temperature. Now, that's really hard to fit into any kind of model where the dark matter is producing radiation, because that would heat up the gas. And it's also hard to fit into any model that we have for, you know, any kind of dark matter that could interact with the gas. I mean, there are a couple of models that have been suggested, and they sort of marginally fit with the data, but it's kind of unclear. So these would be models where, for example, maybe the dark matter has a little bit of electric charge, and that allows an interaction with the gas that can cool down the gas. But it's sort of unclear, and these are models that haven't been studied all that well before, because they were sort of constrained by some other things, and we didn't think that we needed them. And so now a lot of people are kind of trying to put together new possibilities for that. And then there are other things where you could have, for example, maybe instead of making the gas really cold, you could just make the background radiation a lot stronger. And that's a little bit hard to do without heating the gas. But there are certain models of dark matter or other sort of weird exotic physics that have been suggested that could boost up the radiation, and then you could still have more normal sorts of dark matter in there. But it's a complicated question, but it's been one of those things that dark matter physicists have had some fun playing around with what the possibilities are.
Yeah, because there's so many different things that you could change. And I mean, I suppose there are some things that might be dependent on other things as well. How would you even get started? I mean, I suppose there's years worth of previous research to build on.
Yeah, I mean, it's all, you know, it's all in this sort of area of phenomenology, which is kind of where I work, which is you sort of just think about if you have this particular theory, this kind of model, what are all of the consequences that it would have on the physics of the stuff around it, or the physics of, you know, what's actually happening. And in this case, you start with, okay, we have this observation. What can we do with the theories that can create something that'll do that? And there are a lot of theories to play with that are already existing. And then if you're a model builder, you're somebody who creates a new theory that will have a certain interaction that'll allow that to happen. I'm not a model builder. I'm more of a phenomenologist. So I look at sort of what's been proposed before and whether or not these various things would fit together in an interesting way.
Okay, so basically you get to decide if a universe works or not.
Sometimes. I mean, the stuff that I do, I like to tell people, you know, it's fun because it can be really creative. So I get to sit sort of right between the theorists who are creating the new models and the observers who are actually taking data. And I get to be kind of in the middle, and I talk to the theorists and I find out, okay, what are the interesting theoretical models people are putting together? Like, what are the actual equations and what does this look like on paper? And then I talk to the observers and I say, okay, what can this new telescope do? What does the data look like? What are we constraining currently? And then I try and find new connections between those things. So I try and find new ways to constrain or rule out or confirm things about the theory with the kinds of data that we have now or will have in the future. And so there's a lot of like kind of thinking outside the box, like, you know, oh, you know, if I have this model, what does that look like with radio telescopes? You know, that kind of thing. And it can be a lot of fun.
Because I suppose that there is the stereotype, I guess, that scientists are kind of very, very logical, very, I don't know, like not it's not a creative thing, but you're describing a very creative process there, it seems.
Yeah, it is really creative and it is really fun, and there's a lot of, you know, just kind of trying to make connections that other people haven't made before. I mean, that's kind of the holy grail, is to find some connection between two concepts that hasn't been written down, and then you can do some calculation and you have this cool new idea. I have to try to kind of keep up with what's going on in a whole lot of different fields. So I have to understand what all the early universe theorists are doing, what the particle phenomenology people are doing, you know, all the particle theory, all the cosmology theory. And then I have to also know what's going on with all the observations and have a good understanding of a real broad range of astrophysics and cosmology, because that's what's going to allow me to try and make some of those connections. Because you can't just come out of nowhere. You have to be really fully embedded in these things in order to know, like, what's the interesting question, what are the things we know now and what don't we know, and what can we find out. And so I spend a lot of time going to conferences and talking to people and, you know, scouring the literature and trying to get a really, really broad understanding of what's out there. And then that's what I use to try to make those new connections.
Well, I was about to ask you, besides what you directly work on, is there anything else that has captured your interest in kind of the world of astronomy recently? But it sounds like you are, you know, bringing in so many different areas of astronomy, it'd be hard to find one that you're not involved with in some way.
Well, I mean, there's always way more out there that I can possibly work on. So one of the things that I'm really excited about is gravitational waves, and I haven't yet found a way to use those in my own research, but I hope I will soon. I mean, there are a couple of things that you can do with gravitational waves that can tell you about dark matter, and I have a few ideas about it, but it's nothing sort of solid yet. But gravitational waves are an astonishing new window into the universe, and I'm really, really excited about what we're going to learn about black holes, about galaxies, about sort of space-time itself by watching these events of black hole collisions, neutron star collisions. I mean, we've already learned so much, and as LIGO and Virgo and eventually LISA keep going, we're going to see more and more of these collisions, and we're going to learn more and more about the universe in a totally new way. And then, of course, pulsar timing is another possibility that will hopefully tell us a lot about different kinds of black hole collisions, and then we'll learn more about how galaxies come together, and that'll be really interesting too. So there's so much out there that we're learning by being able to, you know, really like feel the vibration of space-time, which I think is such an amazing thing.
So would you say that we're in almost like a golden age of astronomy? There's so much going on at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like every time you open a new window on the universe, you have a kind of possibility for a new golden age, you know? So we've just opened this window, you know, we've just started to be able to see gravitational waves, and, you know, we don't know where that's going to go yet. And that's always a really fun place to be, where you don't know what you're going to get out of it.
Well, I guess we can all just wait with our fingers crossed and maybe get involved if we can, and see where it goes.
Yeah, definitely.
And you mentioned before that you go to all sorts of different conferences to keep up with all these areas of astronomy, and you often use the hashtag academic nomad to describe your travels. So I guess moving on to a little bit of a different topic now, away from the science, is all of the traveling that you do. I mean, it seems like it's a common feature of an academic career is to be going around the world. I mean, just looking at your career history, you've gone from your PhD at Princeton, a fellowship at Cambridge here in the UK, over to Melbourne in Australia. You've worked all around the globe. How have you found that, and how do you still continue to find that?
I mean, it's been a great privilege to be able to see so much of the world and to be able to work in a lot of different places. It's also, you know, it's hard as an academic to pick up and move every few years, you know, and that's a lot of people in academia experience that to varying degrees, where they have to sort of pick up their whole life and move to a new institution, sometimes within the same country and sometimes not. And in my case, I've been crossing oceans, and that can be really hard, because you leave your friends and family, and you have to learn a whole new system, and being in a place where you're not a citizen has its own kind of challenges. And so, you know, that can be really hard, but I tell people I like the travel, I don't so much like the moving, you know, so, but the fact that I've been able to go all over the world to conferences and collaboration visits and workshops and all sorts of things like that, that's been just a fantastic opportunity, and that's not something I would have been able to do if I had not been in academia. You know, I didn't grow up with a whole lot of money, and I wasn't likely to become somebody who would be sort of, you know, jet setting around the world. But in academia, especially in a field like cosmology that's so international, and where these kinds of, you know, exchange of ideas is so important, I've been everywhere for conferences to just meet up with people and talk about ideas and try and connect with people and collaborate on stuff. And that's been an amazing opportunity. And I'm so grateful that I've been able to see so much of the world by doing this. And you know, sometimes it's too much, and sometimes I just want to hide and stay home and not do anything. But it is really nice to have the option and have the opportunity to get around so much.
I mean, I think that's one thing. So this is something that we've had a little bit of feedback on the Jodcast recently. And when we've talked about the human aspect of science and the fact that science is done by humans, and humans are, you know, wonderful creatures on the whole, but, you know, we do get tired and, yeah, you know, well, there's a lot of discussion at the moment about, for example, like sexual harassment in astronomy, you know, there's the racial biases, and that's a discussion that, you know, I think everyone needs to be having at the moment. And you can't, well, I personally don't think you can separate it from the pure science. So I was wondering, you know, what's been your experience of that, you know, throughout your career? Have the conversations changed based on, you know, career level or where you've been in the globe?
The conversations around just like being a human in science, you mean, or specific questions?
Just in general, yeah. So being, you know, the human aspect of science, and I guess any positives or negatives that come from that.
Well, so it's kind of hard to say. I think in the last several years, the conversation about, you know, the impact of the culture of academia on individual people, I think that has gained a lot more prominence. But with a lot of these kinds of conversations, you have to ask yourself if the conversation has been going on and you just haven't been aware of it, or if it's something that has been louder recently, you know. And I think for me, it's both. I've become more aware of the kinds of problems people have and the kinds of challenges that academics face and the kinds of injustices that happen in academia. I do think also that it's been sort of more in the public conversation, at least. So, you know, things like dealing with harassers in academia, that's been getting a lot of press lately. And so there have been a few situations where people have actually faced some consequences for harassment in academia, and not enough, obviously. There's still a lot going on that's not dealt with. But there's starting to be a little bit more pressure on institutions to really make some changes and do something about that, which is good. And there's been a lot of discussion around things like the kinds of discrimination and injustice that people of color face in academia. And so that's a good conversation to have more prominence. But again, you know, it's one of these things where you always have to wonder, like, what did I just not hear about, or what was I not listening to? And you have to really make an effort to listen and to be aware of the privilege that you might have had to not be aware of those conversations in the past. And so that's another thing that I try and always, you know, keep in mind. But yeah, I mean, I do think that more and more people are thinking about this stuff and talking about this stuff, and I hope that that's leading to some change for the better.
No, that's yeah, I would agree with that. That's yeah, and I think it's definitely important to have these conversations as well. And I guess that leads on to another question of mine, in that, so you do a lot of science communication. So, you know, yes, from articles in magazines such as Science, Sky and Telescope to, you know, having a very respectable Twitter following. So I was just wondering how you find that, and, you know, being, I guess, a little bit more in the public eye when it comes to it.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a real mixed bag sometimes, because, like, I mean, there are downsides to having a public profile. One of them, obviously, is that sometimes people yell at you, and that can be unpleasant. And it can be more serious than that. I don't want to make light of it. I've had to talk to the police about a couple of things in the past. But, I mean, you know, I'm fine. But just, you know, just to say that it's not just people yelling. Sometimes things can get bad if you're ever a prominent person online. Anybody has that issue, and if you're sort of more marginalized, you have more of that issue. That's kind of how it goes. And then the other downside is that, you know, it can be distracting. It can take a lot of time. When, you know, as an academic, there are certain things that you really have to spend a lot of your focus on. But the positives have been really great. You know, I've through having a public profile on Twitter and through a lot of writing and things like that, I've been able to connect with some really amazing, interesting people, and I've been able to talk about astronomy to people who wouldn't otherwise maybe have that much connection to it. And I think it's important for a scientist to be in the public eye sometimes just as regular people, you know, so that people who are not connected to academia or science can see that, you know, we're not sort of these ancient, you know, silent people in tops of towers just putting out pronouncements, you know. Like, I think it's important for there to be a dialogue and for there to be interaction and to just have the possibility of presenting ourselves as regular people, not just to, like, you know, so people think better things about scientists, but also so that more people can see themselves as having access to science, having the ability to get involved in science. And so those are some of the things that I really try to do with my public outreach and my writing and all of the social media stuff. But yeah, I mean, fundamentally, I just really like to talk about astronomy and physics and to share that kind of wonder that I have about the universe. And so that's been something that I've had a lot of opportunities to do lately, and I'm really enjoying being able to do that. And right now I'm writing a book, which is another really fun thing and kind of a new experience.
Okay, how's it going? Tell us all about it.
It's a popular level book. It's going to be published by Scribner in 2020, and the topic is the end of the universe, so like the ultimate fate of the cosmos. And it's going to be a book that goes through several possibilities for what might happen at the end of the universe, what it would look like, and how we're trying to figure that out, and like what the science really is and what the process of trying to answer this question looks like. So I'm talking a lot about, you know, the kinds of observations we can do, what we're learning from particle physics, what we're learning from cosmology, what new telescopes are going to show us, and, you know, how we can narrow down these possibilities for what's going to happen in, you know, billions and billions of years, and what can tell us the difference between different kinds of models. But it's a lot of fun to write about ultimate destruction, and probably more fun than it should be, but I'm really enjoying it.
Oh, brilliant. Well, I'll look forward to that when that comes out. I don't know if it's the same over in America at the moment, but one of the things that I think some science communicators have encountered recently over here in the UK is it's lack of trust in experts. I think it's been put across in like, oh, well, how can I believe these scientists that global warming is real or anything like that? So do you encounter anything along that? I suppose astronomy is a little bit more of a neutral topic that maybe people don't get as upset about. You know, do you encounter many people with, you know, these kind of notions?
Yeah, I mean, well, I certainly encounter more of that when I talk about climate change, because that's a thing that some people have very strong opinions about. Some people are very distrustful of experts in any field, and, you know, a lot of times there's this idea that there's this split between the regular people and the elites, you know, and one of the things that really feeds into that notion is when scientists are viewed as these, you know, distant, condescending people who are not connecting with the public and are not regular people themselves. So when those things do come up, I think that it's so important for scientists to be visible and to be approachable and to be in dialogue with people. There's an anti-intellectual kind of anti-elitism thing that happens and that can be really harmful, especially when it comes to stuff like when people stop vaccinating their children because they don't trust doctors or, you know, stuff like that. That can be really bad and really harmful. But I also think it's important to keep in mind that for a lot of people, the idea that scientists don't have regular regular humanity's best interests in mind is not a totally unfounded notion, you know, and there have been in history a lot of situations where the scientific establishment has done really awful things and where people have been lied to or harmed by people who have power over them. And sometimes those are scientists or other intellectuals. And so I think it's important to be aware of that and to recognize and acknowledge that whenever we have conversations about, you know, sort of anti-elitism, anti-intellectualism, stuff like that, because there are real harms that have occurred and in some cases are still occurring, and we need to deal with that and be more responsive to and more understanding of the concerns that people really have. So I don't think it's just a matter of, like, you know, we need to show these ignorant people, you know, what the problem is. I think there really does need to be a dialogue between people who are professional scientists and researchers and people who are not, but whose lives are affected by what scientists do. And that's kind of everybody, right? So it's a matter of being out there, being in conversation, really having that connection with people. And so I do think that that's one of the ways that stuff like social media can be very useful. But I think there are a lot of different things that can be useful in that. You know, things like citizen science is really great for getting people more involved and more connected to the scientific community, and a lot of different kinds of outreach where, you know, scientists go out and have more connection with people around them. You know, there's a lot of different things you can do that will sort of bridge that gap between what we might call the general public, just everybody who's not a scientist, and people who are in this field.
And I guess kind of following on from that, do you get any kind of strange conspiracy theory type questions from people? You know, completely the opposite end there. And if so, how do you deal with them? Do you have any particular favorites that have come into you before?
I mean, I get a lot of messages from people who have their own theories about the universe, you know. So I have a special folder in my email for those kinds of emails. And on Twitter and stuff, people are constantly saying, like, oh, I have an idea about, you know, dark energy or whatever. And those are not necessarily conspiracy theories. Sometimes there's just somebody has an idea and they want to run it by someone. And sometimes there are conspiracy theories where, you know, people will write to me and say that, you know, the speed of light is totally different, and, you know, here's what it should be, and everybody's been lying all this time, you know. So I get those kinds of messages, and occasionally I get messages from people who think that the scientific establishment is against them and is conspiring to silence them, and, you know, if only we would listen, you know, we would have the answers to everything, and some of those can be very, very aggressive. There are a couple of people who just spam the entire physics community to say that they should have won the Nobel Prize, for example. So this kind of thing can happen a lot. And then, of course, there's the sort of flat Earth thing, and I don't even engage with that at all. Like, I mean, I don't answer any of these emails, but with the flat Earth thing, I just, like, I block them on Twitter immediately because, like, that's just so far out there. There's no reason to even engage with that. So yeah, I mean, it happens. I think that people who work in things like medical science or climate science get it a lot worse because there are way more conspiracy theories around those kinds of things. Apparently, if you believe one conspiracy theory, you're likely to believe others. And so whenever you have a kind of group of experts or some kind of established science, there are going to be people who think that it's all lies and everybody else is in on it. And, you know, that's just a thing that can happen, I think.
Well, hopefully by doing the science communication work, you know, that you do, and I was putting out the Jodcast as well, hopefully we can, help with that a little bit, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. I think just generally having science and professional scientists kind of pervading more of culture can be really useful.
And you mentioned that you're writing a book at the moment in terms of your science communication work. What else is coming up in your world of science? What's what you're hoping to work on next?
Oh gosh, I'm doing so many things. well, so the big thing is the book. You know, that That'll be out in a year and a half or so, probably. But I still write, for Cosmos Magazine, which is an Australia-based science magazine, and every quarter I have a column in that. I appear on podcasts once in a while, but kind of at random, so I don't have my own podcast or anything. I do a lot of different presentations, like, in real life. There are some interesting things there, but... You know, nothing where I would want to sort of promote it at the moment, because there's a lot of stuff that's not quite yet public, I guess. But yeah, in terms of research, well, so I'm still working on a whole bunch of stuff related to dark matter. I have a paper that hopefully will be coming out soon that is really wild stuff. So I don't want to say too much about it before it's out, but it's a kind of a side project that has to do with some very kind of exotic physics and relates a bit to the end of the universe. So keep an eye out for that, I guess. And one of the things about writing a book about the end of the universe is that you think a lot about the end of the universe. And so I've been able to incorporate some of the thinking into some of my research, which is a lot of fun. So yeah, I don't know. I'm just kind of always doing little things here and there, rather than, I don't have like a really big project other than the book and my general research direction, which is mostly in dark matter, but then a whole bunch of other things.
Well, I was going to say, it sounds like you're doing so many things. It's I wonder that you've got the time to do any of them.
I mean, I don't. You know, I have my day job, which is everything to do with my job at the university, and then I have my nights and weekends job, which is all of the science communication, and I'm trying to compress more of that into sort of business hours, but there's a lot, there's always so much to do, and I enjoy it, you know, but it can be all-encompassing sometimes, so I'm still working on trying to find ways to better balance, you know, taking breaks and just chilling out, but that's a work in progress.
I was going to say, if you find anything based on that, can you let me know as well? Because I think a lot of people.
Well, this is the problem with academia, though, is that like in academia, there's never a time when you're just done. You know, like there's always stuff you could be working on that would be, you know, somehow better for your career to be working on that. And trying to find balance and trying to find a level of overwork or you know, working just the right amount that works for you is a real challenge. And I think everybody in academia faces that challenge of finding a way to compartmentalize the work that they do and to find a good balance between things that let you relax and take a break from work and the actual work itself. And I think that's super important. I think everybody should be focusing a lot on that kind of work-life balance, because otherwise you can really do harm to yourself. But I don't think there's any like one sort of formula for it. Everybody kind of has to figure that out for themselves.
Yeah. So what kind of things do you, on the subject of work-life balance, what kind of things do you like to do outside of, you know, your research and outside of science communication?
So when I travel for work, I try and always take a little bit of time to just wander around and see the city or whatever. And that's something that I really enjoy is I like travel in general. And so taking some time to do a little bit of tourism when I'm traveling for work is one of the things that I do to chill out, I guess. But I also try and exercise as much as I can. I know that's really important to do, so I go out running and I sometimes play sports and, you know, whatever I have an opportunity to do. I try and do that as much as I can. And other than that, I don't know, I read books about science fiction. I try and make sure that, you know, that I'm not spending the whole weekend working, because I think that can be really bad. And some weekends I don't work at all, and sometimes that's bad for my progress, but I think it's important to have boundaries. And so I for example, I try not to answer work emails on the weekend. And if I do have to work on the weekend, I try and do it in like a nice coffee shop downtown or something like that, you know? So there's kind of, you kind of have to set your own boundaries and find the kinds of balance that work for you.
Yeah. Like that goes back to the scientists are people too.
Yes. Yeah. 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 And I try and go outside. I know that sounds kind of trivial, but when you work at a desk all the time, you know, you can forget to do that. But like, so last weekend I went out into the forest a little bit and that was really good. So those kinds of things can be important.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on this Jodcast adventure. It sounds like you're an incredibly busy person. So thank you so much for taking the time out to speak to me today.
Well, thanks for having me. It was really fun.
No, it's. I'm just conscious that we've been speaking for a very long time, and yeah. You should go and enjoy the rest of your Sunday.
Okay, I'll do that.